Hello everyone, it's Nathaniel from The Film Experience, and I'm here with Joe Reed.
Hello!
And Nick Davis.
Hey! I forgot to admit that I did have a life event to share last time.
Oh, what was that?
I got to interview Jane Campion for an hour on the phone.
Woo!
What?
Yeah, it was while you were away in Connecticut. Things happened.
Well, what percentage of that time did you spend talking about Portrait of a Lady?
Only a little bit. Because, like, only a little bit. Less than we talked about, like, my origin story being completely dependent on her.
Yeah.
Which was awesome. And the first thing she said was, like, you really need to meet the actor Paul Schneider. He told me a really similar story, and I cast him in my movie. Like, are you implying that you're going to cast me in your movie? Like,
are you flirting with me?
Yeah. She was so awesome. So, like, there's a full retrospective of all of her movies happening at Lincoln Center in September, which is also when Top of the Lake China Girl will show up on American TV. And so that was the double occasion for the interview for a film comment. And it was completely, exactly. She was so great and totally cheerful and so accessible. It was so awesome.
Well, I was going to say how I should have phrased my question was, what 10% of the time allotted to you after the piano and your origin story did you spend talking about other movies?
Well, I kept asking her questions like, did you guys read at Cannes how they showed China Girl all for 6 hours, and
yeah.
then she was encouraging audience members to come talk to her during breaks and, like, you know, harbor their guesses about who the killer was and stuff?
Yeah.
And so I was curious, like, which movie are you really interested to watch with an audience and, like, feel their reaction at your retrospective? And we talked a lot about In the Cut.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I guess that's probably her most misunderstood.
Yes. And she did, you know, allow that she thinks that Portrait of a Lady is also maybe a way better movie than it got credit for being at the time, in her opinion. But, but those were the two that came up then, but In the Cut especially. But that she does feel like younger film lovers are really intrigued by that movie and see things in it that its initial audience didn't, which has been really gratifying to her.
Good.
That's cool. I can't wait to read that. When is that interview gonna be published?
They're gonna run a short version in the September-October issue of the magazine, but the full transcript will be online. I'm not sure when.
Okay.
I have to transcribe it today.
Exciting.
Yay!
Yeah, I love that was a life event. You just casually forgot to mention.
I totally forgot. Yeah. It's like, it's too good to keep in my mind sometimes.
Yeah.
Unlike some movies, which, you know.
Yeah.
Leave your mind, but because they weren't so good.
Right.
Like, I keep forgetting, and I actually like the movie, but I keep forgetting I saw Spider-Man Homecoming.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I feel like that one stuck with me more than most.
Yeah. Well, Nick, you haven't seen that one, right?
I have not, but...
Are you doing a...
I only thought about seeing it because of Marissa Tomei...
Yeah.
...and Rihanna Umbrella lip-sync battle.
Yes.
Did I make a mistake by not seeing it?
Well, those are two good reasons to see it, although they aren't really shown within the movie.
Yeah, you'll be disappointed if you go in being like, I'm going to see the new Marissa Tomei movie. So maybe wait for a home video viewing where you can fast forward to her scenes.
What about Jennifer Connelly?
Oh, yeah, which I totally didn't catch during the movie, but, like, it's kind of a cute little, you know, in-joke, essentially, that she's the voice of the computer program that's, like, within his suit, his spider suit.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, essentially serving the same purpose as Paul Bettany did for those early Iron Man movies.
Oh, I didn't even catch this.
Yeah, I know. I didn't notice it. I made a point to go back and look up on IMDb to see who the voice was, because I remember thinking during the movie that, like, oh, I bet that's somebody. And yeah, Jennifer Connelly. She's actually quite charming. It's probably my favorite Jennifer Connelly performance in several years.
Ooh, damning with faint praise.
Yeah, guilty.
It is. Did you guys read that piece in Vulture from Kyle Buchanan, The Revenge of the Twinks?
I did not.
No. That's
funny. Yeah, It was pretty great. And it was about how this summer movie season has unexpectedly been a twink fest. And since last time we were talking about Baby Driver. And then we have Tom Holland in this. And then Dunkirk. Which we will also discuss after Spider-Man.
Hopefully exclusively in terms of twinks.
Yeah.
But Spider-Man, I don't have a lot to say about it other than I continue to think that the entire reason to make them is that Tom Holland is kind of perfect for it.
He really honestly is so great.
But otherwise, like, it just, you know, yeah, another Spider-Man movie, you know.
I don't know. I thought this one did a lot of things that I sort of hadn't realized I had been wanting out of a Spider-Man movie, especially, like I love the sort of environment they put him in with this sort of, like, you know, science and technology magnet school where he's, you know, he's still, you know, not the most popular kid, but, like, in this one, like, the, you know, the bully is still, like, a quiz team bully, like, that kind of thing. Like, I like the sort of little tweaks they make into your average sort of high school movie setup. I like everything that they did with all the other kids. I love that, like, all the other kids are, like, kids who you liked in other movies that were, like, basically, like, brought in the all-star team of,
yeah,
like,
totally.
The kid from Grand Budapest Hotel and the kid from Beasts of No Nation and the kid from Little Men, and it's everybody's sort of, you know, brought in together. I don't know. I just thought they did a really good job of making him a regular kid so that, like, the Spider-Man stuff really seemed to mean more. I think it felt his sort of identity as a superhero feels earned in this one in a way that you didn't necessarily get out of the other five Spider-Man movies previously.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a good sell.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it well enough. I am just always waiting, since these movies get their more than their fair share of attention as cinema goes. I keep hoping that they will, like, live up to how much attention. I keep hoping they will earn the attention that they automatically get.
And you don't think this one did?
No, I don't. I think very rarely do they. And even I tend to like them. Like, I get why, you know, they're always well, or usually the Marvel movies at least are always well reviewed. I mean, they tend to be very competent and sometimes really fun movies, but the amount of attention they get, I keep wanting them to earn it, you know? Which I think a couple of them did. Like Winter Soldier.
I think within the Marvel universe, I think this is another building block in a story that I find very interesting in that they're telling these sort of superhero stories that do, like, they're making use of this shared world beyond just the fact that it's this sort of marketing gambit, in that they're telling the story of superheroes in a world where, like, everything that happens needs to get kind of dealt with in the aftermath and cleaned up. Like, the whole supervillain of this movie comes from somebody who is essentially, like, he's a junk salvager, and he wants to salvage the junk from the wreckage of the first Avengers movie.
The incident, as people call it.
What's that?
The incident.
Yes.
Isn't that what they call it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's just a whole ecosystem in the greater sort of Marvel universe of, you know, it's not these sort of, like, consequence-free sort of, you know, superhero events. And whether, you know, you want to sort of, I watched Batman Forever last night, and sort of remembering that, like, that was the environment that superhero movies existed in these kind of sort of candy-colored cartoon, like, live-action cartoon kind of things. And, like, that's perfectly, like, I suppose, valid way of doing it. But, like, I like the fact that the Marvel Universe is committing to itself and finding ways in which it operates like an ecosystem that sort of makes sense, that sort of, you know, would logically flow from one to another, and finding ways to connect this movie to the Marvel stuff in a way that feels organic to this character, which I liked.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I like all of that, too. I mean, that's what Marvel does really well, but I do think it sometimes gets in the way. Like, I think this movie would have been so much better without Iron Man in it. even though I get why he's, I get that they're trying to interconnect everything, but it just, it to me, it was distracting because I wanted to watch a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, but I granted, but also I feel like he serves a that sort of, you know, mentor function in this, in that he, you know, there's a lot of like classic storytelling functions that Tony Stark serves in this, in that he's sort of the guy who bestows the gifts upon this character, and mm-hmm. also, you know, gives him these sort of like mantras to live by, and yet also he's the like disapproving father figure, and yet also like I think it's he's there for more than just corporate synergy.
Yeah, but I also think it becomes like such a crutch, like that like fairy sequence, which I think is the probably the best action sequence within the movie. To me, like the whole time, like even though I was enjoying the scene because I think it was, you know, the best action scene, I knew, oh well, I just was expecting when Iron Man would save it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it was the whole like Deus Ex Machina, or I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, where you just know that something unrelated will come in to solve the problem.
Yeah,
you know?
I get that. Yeah.
And to me, that just cuts out the tension, you know?
Yes, I get that. I think for me, the idea of all of these Marvel movies existing in this framework of a team, even if, like, Spider-Man isn't really technically part of this team yet,
yeah,
I think that there is... There, you know, there is something that exists sort of outside of there, and sometimes it'll show up and sometimes it won't. And,
yeah.
But no, I get what you're saying about wanting the character to sort of stand on his own.
Yeah, I mean, I like most of these movies. I just want them to really be the best their best selves, and I feel like I really felt what Joss Whedon was complaining about with his second Avengers movie, where he just was so hemmed in by all of the demands that were required to you know, advance like the overall universe stuff from what he actually wanted to do within the movie. You know what I'm saying?
I do, except also, like, I think Age of Ultron actually turned out really well. And sometimes I sort of look at, you know, those Joss Whedon comments have become kind of gospel among, you know, movie fans and film critics and whatnot. And sometimes I wonder if maybe we could look at that as a little bit more of just like an overworked director bitching about what he's going to bitch about.
Oh yeah, sure. And like, I also think the movie's better than it gets credit for being, but
I've watched it a lot lately because it's on Stars, and I have Stars from when I signed up for cable and we got it for free. And I always end up sticking around till the end when I catch it flipping through the channel. So
I mean, it does have some great stuff in it. Like, I love everything to do with the Vision in it.
Yeah, and Scarlet Witch, too. Yeah. Anyway, this is not a podcast.
Right,
that. Right. Cold. Nick doesn't get to talk about any of this.
Sorry, let's move on.
Unless he's already left, has given up and washed his hands of this entire conversation.
I'm thinking about Jane, I'm good.
You've moved on from Marissa Tomei, even. You're like, they haven't mentioned Marissa once in their reviews of Spider-Man.
I mean, we can think about both, you know. We're thinking about Marissa Tomei.
So let's talk Dunkirk.
Let's.
I just saw that yesterday.
And I want to know which format you guys saw it in, since everybody's so obsessed with format. And I will just say this right off the bat, I'm not one of those cinephiles who really thinks that much about formats. I just like to see things on the screen. Like, yeah. I don't actually think, is this in 70mm? Is this in IMAX? I just like going to the movies. As opposed to like screeners or whatever. So I saw it in IMAX, but I don't know. I didn't even realize that it would be different versus 70 mm versus IMAX. I thought it was kind of like the same deal. Like, you know.
Wait, so you did see it in IMAX?
I did, yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
I saw it in 70 mm, but not IMAX.
Same.
Okay. So my one complaint, which turned out to be not... My major complaint, which turned out to be not major given what the movie was trying to do, was that I literally could not understand a single line of dialogue during the action sequences. But it was also a movie that was like the dialogue meant nothing. You know, it was like a cinema in terms of moving pictures was what it was after.
So I
was
everything sort I was of okay felt like that. A choice to me.
Huh?
Yeah.
I said the cacophony of sounds sort of felt like a choice to me.
But was that true in 70mm as well? Could you guys make out the dialogue?
No.
Yeah, not particularly, especially during like the flying sequences and a lot of the scenes on the ship. Beyond, like, besides the one where like Harry Styles is trying to get the French guy killed. Yeah, it's not. I don't know. Some, I guess, better than others. Like, because of all the like Mark Rylance stuff, feels it's the most character-y of, you know, the three sections. Mm-hmm. But I think for the most part, and it sort of sounds like I'm damning it with faint praise, but like I was really impressed by the fact that Nolan was able to make me feel as much as I did without really presenting characters, like without really like presenting a story through characters as much as sort of massive movements of mm-hmm. of things and events and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really care that I missed all that dialogue. I just wondered if it would have added to the experience if I knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
I was thinking the same, that it just, it feels like at this point, in the same way that Robert Altman was like, I'm just going to let the dialogue overlap, and you guys are going to have to deal with that. That's my choice. That he's like, I don't care if people understand the dialogue all the time. That's what I'm doing on purpose. Like, I feel like you can't be that meticulous with the image and just not get it, that we can't always make out your characters. Like, he must have be attached to this in some way, but
right.
It was not improved.
Yeah, but setting. I mean, but I'm actually speaking literally, like, I didn't understand a single line of Tom Hardy's dialogue, which I think is kind of like a Tom Hardy thing, especially in Christopher Nolan movies. Let's put a mask over his face when he's already a mumbling actor.
Yeah.
I just didn't... I realized that's not the point of the movie. The dialogue was not the point of the movie. And interestingly enough, right after I saw it, I went to a screening of Detroit.
Ooh, right.
And I was wishing that Catherine Bigelow had not let me hear the dialogue.
Oh, wow. Spoiler.
Well, that's not a spoiler. I liked Detroit, but some of the dialogue, I was like, that would have been better if I hadn't heard that, you know?
Yeah.
There were some clunky lines in that one. Whereas we all know she can direct the shit out of, like, tension and action.
Yeah. Take that, Mark Bull.
What?
I said, take that, Mark Bull.
But did the Dunkirk, I don't want to sound like I didn't like it, because I did really, but like it also, there were a lot of parts that didn't work for me, like in addition to the dialogue. Like, I didn't really get a lot from the three time frames. Like, I thought it was interesting, like it kept me interested in the movie, that I was realizing we were, you know, not completely linear. But I'm not sure it really added to the experience.
I liked the way that it made things feel like things were zoning in and targeting in on a fixed point. Like, I felt like that was an interesting way to feel the movie sort of approximate what was happening in the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think it invites you to have to do a lot of mental, like, lining things up in a way that you don't ultimately in the end really need to have done. I think it maybe makes a little bit of unnecessary work for the viewer, in that, like, I kept being like, okay, like, trying to sort of like piece together, like, this is happening before this and this and this, and ultimately I didn't really need to do that at all. So if I see it, you know, when and if I see it again, I'll know then not to really, you know, overly
sweat that too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I sort of felt the same, and like, even those semi-inscrutable chapter titles is probably the wrong word, but just the indications of like 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour at the beginning.
Yeah, they're not misleading, but they're too vague, probably a little too vague.
Yeah, and I couldn't totally work out why you're seeming to provide us information, but not in a way that's legible, really.
Right.
And it seemed like a strange thing to distract us with, but I liked the movie too, and I felt like it the whole thing was about, like, seeing what a World War II movie would look like through Christopher Nolan's recurrent obsessions from movie to movie, and including this one. And so if it hadn't been executed so well, I might have been more irritated or felt like that was a crutch for him. And even though I totally agree that it seemed kind of gratuitous by the end and you could just leave it out if you wanted to, I'm kind of glad about that, because if it felt like the movie depended on that, I would have been kind of annoyed with him, like, yeah, or felt like he was resorting to old tricks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, given that structure, I guess what I kept expecting was something more along the lines of that shopping mall sequence in Jackie Brown.
Uh-huh.
Where I thought specific scenes, we would revisit them three times.
I see.
Yeah.
Which I guess we did a tiny bit, but not in really legible ways.
Yeah. Or ways that really hugely changed our sense of what we had seen. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that was, I found it a little distracting, even though I liked it in concept, if that makes sense.
And when you have all of these sort of, like, young men who look plausibly similar to each other.
Yes.
Trying to, like, see if, like, the ones you see now are the ones you're seeing covered in, like, oil and, you know, getting pulled from the sea. And it's just like, yes, ultimately, again, that doesn't really matter. The only real characters you need to concern yourself with are on Mark Rylance's boat, like, basically. And yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a thing where it's, if I liked the movie less, I would probably bitch about it more. I think the movie all really works for me, and I was surprised by how, because the thing with Nolan is, you know, he's a technician, but he doesn't have human feelings or whatever, yada yada, and yet like, I was incredibly moved by a lot of things at the end of this movie. Not just the, like, sort of heartstring pulling of, like, when you see the newspaper at the end and, like, the kid is, you know, in the headline as a hero, like that, of course. But, like, even, like, other little things of just sort of, you know, Tom Hardy flying his plane into, you know, enemy territory and all that. And just sort of these little moments of, you know, seeing these boats show up. And I don't know, it was very, I was very kind of impressed by how emotionally open it felt for being such a, like, technician's movie.
Yeah, I didn't get, I didn't have that experience with it. I didn't get a lot of emotion from it, but I also didn't, I guess, need that much, because to me it was a technician's movie and I was enjoying the sort of mastery of it, like, which was why I'm glad I saw it in IMAX, because it did feel like an overwhelming sensory experience sometimes. Like, I was like, I could feel that thing you sometimes feel at really good action movies where, like, oh, I've been, my hand hurts because I've been, like, gripping my seat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that part I enjoyed. And I was wondering, when we were talking about all the guys looking similar, I kind of wish that I thought that was a choice, as opposed to, but there's been so many movies where I feel like the casting director didn't bother to differentiate. And it's especially a problem on like television, especially like the CW or whatever. But there seem to be a lot of casting directors who don't think, oh, gee, I've cast an entire cast full of brunettes, for example.
Christopher Nolan's had a pretty clear type his whole career almost.
Yeah.
Seems like it since Batman Begins. It's been like, I'm interested in chiseled, slightly inaccessible brunettes. Are you? I even thought, like, you know, the one guy I can comfortably pick out is the blonde, and I don't even need to because he's by himself on a boat. Like, goddamn. Like, couldn't he be one of the people in the ship? But, he's quite compelled by that. It's like his version of the Tim Burton platinum hair, dark eyebrows. Like, just give him a brunette. Rudy brunette.
Yeah, I mean, I just, but I wish that I felt like it was a choice as opposed to just, like, a fetish.
His thing, yeah.
Because, you know, I kept trying to, like, I didn't know his name at the time, but I kept trying to be like, okay, wait, am I looking at Finn Whitehead or the British guy playing the French guy or you know, Harry Styles for a second, like, if they're, especially when they're in, like, medium shots or whatever.
Yep, I agree.
And maybe, I wanted to think that was the point, because then it could be more of, like, a statement about the sort of impersonality of war.
Yeah.
But I also feel like it wasn't the point because they did make a... Well, I don't want to go into spoilers about who dies, but I really felt like it was clearly not... He was clearly not trying to make a point about the impersonality of war. Because they clearly specified, you know, who did what and, you know, who got killed and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think it can still be both, right?
It could be, but I don't think it was.
Mm-hmm. Or even if it's not both deliberately, like, it did have a version of that effect on me, even though it was also doing the other things you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I've seen too much to think it was a choice. A conscious choice.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, and I agree, too, about being moved by it, but like you were saying, Joe, it was... Often it wasn't those sort of big emotional beats of the newspaper and stuff, but, like, just even, like, pulling your buddy at the last minute from between where the boat is about to smash into the dock, you know? Or, like, that those things that were kind of technical mastery scenes or things where, like, whatever it was in the movie, the music, the focus pulling, the shot composition was also the thing that, even if it just moved me for 4 seconds, it frequently did that.
And
that was a kind of welcome surprise. It did also mean that I saw it with my brother, and I was trying to like explain why his movies are so elegant, and his color palettes and his style and everything are so consistent, more or less, from movie to movie that it never stops totally feeling like a spectacle that has been mounted for his eye.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because I actually enjoyed his eye. But it's not in the way that that first third of Saving Private Ryan is also an incredible demonstration of mastery, but you definitely feel like the war is still going on every side of the frame, and the camera just happens to be there. You know, like, this did feel oriented toward Nolan a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I can see being... I didn't find myself being too annoyed by that, even if it did feel like a limitation in a certain sense, but I get it that I could see being more irritated by that.
Yeah.
If people want. But, yeah, I liked it. I was impressed.
I keep getting convinced and talked out of liking Christopher Nolan movies every time. I feel like every time I sort of, like, really enjoy them, and then I kind of allow myself to be talked into the idea that I didn't. Sort of Interstellar, and then, you know, so many sort of very smart people are like, no, but you were manipulated and it was bad and the score and yada yada, and so then I always have to sort of like end up like coming back around the back end and just be like, well, I think I really liked Inception. It's like, yeah, you done it the first time, like, stop letting other people sort of talk you out of it. And so I think I'm trying very hard to like be more steadfast in this, and just like, I really liked Dunkirk, and I'm maybe not going to allow the fact that I don't like the tone of a lot of Nolan's most partisan, you know, fanboys on the internet to allow me to be swayed by the people who aren't.
Well, I actually have the opposite thing, where I feel like I need to trust myself more with him, because I found myself the first time I watched Inception, you know, because I have a lot of issues with Nolan as a filmmaker, and I found myself making excuses for, oh, well, just try to like see this how other people see it, because, you know, it's, and it sort of disguised how much I didn't like Inception. And so it was only the second time I saw it where it's like, wow, my first instinct, I think it's a bad movie, and I know everybody thinks it's a masterpiece, and I just think it's bad. And so it's like,
I don't know if everybody thinks it's a masterpiece. Only I do.
So, yeah. So I'm trying to learn to trust myself more. So I was when I was watching Dunkirk, I was like, okay, just try not to think about every feeling you've had about other Nolan movies.
Yeah.
Just watch it. Try not to think about people saying it's the best movie of the year. It's going to win everything.
It's irritating to me that we can't like. It almost makes very little sense to me that this is the one filmmaker who we can't watch anything without, you know, having to get caught up in what everybody else is saying. It's like, why him sometimes? I always sometimes wonder, like, why he's become this great lightning rod of mm-hmm. film culture. But here we are.
Well, I mean, I think in some... I mean, this is going to sound so reductive, and I really don't mean it this negatively, but in some ways, he's, like, sort of the perfect, like, bro filmmaker. Because it's...
See, I don't... I feel like he gets tagged with that, though, and I don't think it's deserved.
Really? Because, like, he literally... I mean, I think the reason I have issues with him is partially because the things he doesn't care about are the things I care most about.
Uh-huh.
So, like, he really has no concept of like, or no interest in women.
Right.
Which I find really hard to watch across an entire filmography.
Uh-huh, I get that.
And, because, like, even Scorsese, you know, who's, like, such a, you know, masculine, in quotes, filmmaker.
Even Scorsese made one movie about women.
No, but
years.
Also he has, like, really vivid occasional female characters where I feel like Nolan never even manages that.
Yeah.
So, I
get why not being interested in women, which he seems to mostly not be, isn't necessarily the same as, like, bro-y, right?
Yeah, except for that the ways he does try... occasionally express interest in them is always in really bro-y ways, like I'm gonna obsess over this female character because she means this to a man.
Yeah,
like there's like such a reductivity to it that I have trouble with it. It's always like, you know, it's like the whole dead wives thing, or like there's something about it that makes me like profoundly uncomfortable.
I get it.
And so like to me that's, but. So anyway, I think he's what I'm trying to say in a really inelegant way is that he's very mainstream in his concerns, and those concerns are his interests are things that a lot of men are interested in, including what type of movies he's interested in making: thrillers, action movies, Batman movies. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of it is, I think he sort of, a lot of it is the people who are loudest in his favor too, in that, you know, they do him no favors.
Right.
Yeah.
And I at least I get from film Twitter that we've sort of, like, gone full circle now, and people now think that the people who have issues with him are the problem. You know, it used to be, like, his fans were the problem.
Listen, somebody's got to have a problem. So. Gotta blame someone. I blame Sean Spicer. But,
I mean,
you know.
Yeah, the whole... It's funny because, like, this coming out the same summer as Beguiled, and I just find so many parallels with the Sofia Coppola conversation.
I've been thinking about that too, actually. Yeah.
Because they are both so auteurs in, like, the classic sense of, like, it's impossible not to know it's their movie.
That's the thing. I think with both of them, sometimes where I come down to it is just sort of like, stop trying to lecture these filmmakers out of being the filmmakers that they are.
Yeah.
Like, if we want something that they're not providing, like,
go to
seek
some other filmmaker. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, it becomes like, if they have an extensive enough filmography, that type of director becomes sort of fun. Just,
yeah.
Okay, let's see which variation of their obsession they're playing this week,
right.
You know.
Which isn't to say don't, like, criticize the films in and of themselves, but I think there's a lot of, with both of them, people being like, oh my god, why don't they just make this kind of movie or XY kind of movie? And it's like, well, they're not going to do that. Like,
right.
Maybe, you know, within what they do, you know, criticize the success or failure of that. But, like, this whole idea of, like, when is Sofia Coppola going to make a woke movie? And it's like, never? And I'm fine with that.
The other version of which is like, you're welcome to watch the Darjeeling Limited, but I would really discourage you from doing that. Like, you know, stay in the lane, maybe. I don't know. But I mean, clearly, it's like the context for those comments is like, if there were, I know we're all agreeing about this, but like, if there were more the kinds of movies that privilege the kinds of tones or characters or viewpoints that those two get accused of not representing, it wouldn't be as big a deal.
Correct.
Right?
So absolutely.
It's hard to say, like, well, go watch everybody else.
But, no, that is true. That is definitely true.
Oh, yeah, that is true, but that's also...
They can totally report for on their own, for sure.
Right. I guess I was having this conversation with Murtada last night. We went out to dinner and talked about Sofia Coppola for, like, an hour. But,
I'm shocked.
Because he has very strong feelings about The Beguiled, so... very strong negative feeling. So but it was really interesting discussion, but my thing with her and the reason I feel so protective and defensive of her is that people don't seem to realize that her concerns are not concerns that ever, you know, people, you know, are always talking about representation. But the type of thing Sophia is interested in talking about is not something that other filmmakers do at all. So, like, to me, that's like serving up a vision that nobody has served up. So to me, that's important too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what other filmmaker has like six movies about like lost little rich girls? You know what I'm saying?
Even like, it's played by Kendorf, yes.
Yeah, it's very, very ultra specific. And to me, I'm like, just so admit that that's what she does.
Yeah.
And then, you know, discuss whether or not she does it successfully.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, talking about her bubble. Yes, she's in a bubble, but so is Nolan. It's just that his is more mainstream.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you, but I can also see that why it feels like a kind of concession to a lot of people to go straight to just evaluate them on their own terms when the critique they're trying to make is like, but the minute you do that and just enter their own terms, we've missed all the parts of the discussion I'm trying to have, you know, like, why are their terms? But
no, I get that too, and Murtada made sure I got that last night.
We took this some places, you guys.
We did. I feel like there's so much more to say about Dunkirk, and I just can't for life of me think of what else I wanted to say about it. Although I'm curious if you guys thought of any other movies while watching it, because I did have, even though it's like so Nolan in so many ways, one movie it did kind of remind me of was Wings.
Oh, I've never seen Wings. Someone else, though, mentioned Mrs. Miniver on Twitter, and I was also interested in that, and I've never seen that movie either.
Oh, they're both so much worth seeing, Joe.
Yeah, I know. I have 24 hours in a day, and there's only so much Real World Road Rules Challenge I can watch.
So. I was really, this isn't exactly an answer to your question, but I guess in ways that I wasn't thinking about other movies, I was surprised that Dunkirk wasn't a beach evacuation movie, and it was way more an air and water movie, which was not what I expected out of that event.
Yeah.
And especially when you, by the end, cut back, I guess, and see that there are still all these huge lines of guys, which is where we start also.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I definitely think the movie would have a hard time accommodating a whole other thread, but it just was a kind of different contextualizing of what Dunkirk might look like on a screen, that there's not one thread that's about somebody on the beach trying to like duck for cover or figure out where to possibly be.
Yeah.
I know the like hiding out in the hull of the boat is a little bit of that predicament, but we mostly know those guys on the water at a certain point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that bit in the hull of the boat was maybe the set piece that I found least rewarding in a way.
You mean when the boat floods?
Well, just everything that happens inside that boat. The argument with...
Are you talking about the last... Or the boat...
The empty boat on the beach. And everybody inside it. And the arguments about who stays and who goes. And then... Like, I absolutely do not watch war movies being like, well, he should have done this, because I am not in that situation. You know, like, I totally... Like, I make huge allowances for that. But I still was kind of like, cocking one eyebrow about like plugging the holes. Seems like the thing right now. Like, that's not. There's 32 of them, but you know, whatever. Okay. it just felt like that bit was having a hard time. Every other strand in the movie, I guess I'll say, already knows there is so much going on in every single situation, and so many like plates are spinning all the time that he can only deal with like one or two of them. And it's perfectly suspenseful. And that one felt like it was actually kind of trying to come up with ways to make sitting inside an empty boat feel like enough.
Yeah, I agree.
But by contrast to which, like, even his... I thought it was really inventive the way that he even turns good situations, like boarding a big ship that's going to take you out into something totally tense the whole time. All the different devices that he thought of for making that ominous.
Beyond the obvious. Yeah, I think the opening is really strong. Like the first major event of trying to board that ship.
Yeah.
Was there any specific, we should wrap up, but was there any specific shot that just encapsulated what you thought was strongest about the movie? Because I have an idea.
Why don't you? Because I can't think of anything specific.
The moment when I was just like, wow, you know, this movie is really working on a technical and an emotional level, even though I didn't find it as moving as some people do, was when they were first on the beach, so like right when the movie's starting to get going. When the first time that the planes attack.
Oh, when the lineup of the explosions?
The lineup of the explosions where it's like out of focus and you're just watching the first guy that you meet, you're just watching him duck.
Yeah.
But you're seeing the explosions coming toward him. I thought that shot was so superb and elegant and really encapsulates how gripping the movie is.
Yeah.
There's another shot down that long walkway where they're all lined up, where the ones in the foreground start ducking, and then you see it sort of like wave all the way down to the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where they all start ducking, and it's sort of just like, it's that kind of stuff where you get this like huge sense of scale very like simply, was really fantastic.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Thanks for tuning in. Go see Dunkirk on whichever format you choose.
No, actually, go to the theater.
Yeah.
No, well, that's the only way to see it, is the theater.
My students say otherwise. Don't do that shit.
Don't do that.
Oh, no. Right. No, don't do illegal things. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
also just, like, shitty things. Like, that won't be fun. Don't do that.
Yeah. Don't wait for it to come on VOD. Like,
no, it's definitely a big screen movie.
Watch it on a movie theater. They're nice and air conditioned. It's so hot out. Don't pay for your own air conditioning.
And even though I didn't understand a word of the dialogue, I thought IMAX was special for that movie, even though I don't normally care about, like, ooh, I want to see that in IMAX.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't like the IMAX theaters because there's no aisles, and you know I love an aisle, so.
That's true. Who doesn't?
Jerks.
All right, thanks for listening, and bye.
Bye.
I couldn't think of an ending for that one.
It's funny how some movies end that way. bye. Okay, bye.